It is my great pleasure to introduce today's speaker, David Chang. David did his PhD at Penn, which is where I first got to know him, and did work on parsing both Chinese and DNA, right?
Yes.
Two foreign languages. And went from there to do a postdoc at the University of Maryland with Philip Resnick, where he got his first best paper award at ACL for a paper on...
HIRO.
Oh, HIRO was at Maryland.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So, and then went to ISI, where he's been ever since, where he got his second best paper award on...
Discriminative training for MT.
Discriminative training. Oh, okay. So I thought the HIRO one was ISI. And he is gracing our workshop with his presence this summer, just before moving to... I can announce this, right?
Yeah, it's on the slide.
Okay. Notre Dame University, yes, for a faculty position. Here we go. In the fall. So, and today he's going to tell us about neural networks for machine translation.
Okay, thank you. So this part of this talk includes joint work with Victoria Fossum, who is a postdoc with us at ISI. My student Ashish Vaswani, who just graduated, is staying at ISI, and Yingong Zhao, who is at Nanjing University. And this topic, neural networks for machine translation, is a very timely one. Actually, my student Ashish Vaswani started talking to me about this topic like 5 years ago. He came back from a summer internship and said, this is a really interesting topic. And I said, this is crazy stuff. Why do you keep telling me about this stuff? I'm not interested in this. This is never going to work. And maybe about 3 years ago, then neural networks, as you heard yesterday, basically took over the speech world. And I started to think, oh, maybe Ashish was right. And maybe I'll get interested in this also. And we started doing some stuff on it. And now this year is like the year of explosion of neural networks at ACL. And definitely is a very timely topic right now. So I'm going to try to give you just a little bit of flavor of the use of neural networks in machine translation. It is definitely a very fluid topic right now, so I definitely can't give you like a full survey of all the stuff that people are trying. I'm giving you a very, very narrow taste of what's going on, but hopefully a pretty practical and useful slice of this topic. So I'm gonna give this talk in three parts. The first part will be a very gentle introduction to neural networks. I suspect about one third of you are experts on neural networks, and two thirds of you are maybe less than expert on neural networks. So I'm just gonna give you a very basic introduction to neural networks. And then I'm gonna talk about some work we've done at ISI on fast training of neural networks that's particularly well suited to work on text and especially on translation. And then I'm gonna talk specifically about the application of neural networks to machine translation, talking both about work done at ISI and also at BBN, so the best paper award from ACL, which was mentioned during the discussion yesterday. I'll be mentioning that as well. Okay, so introduction to neural networks. This is, like I said, this is going to be a really basic introduction. If you have a question that is like, I don't understand this, can you explain it better, please feel free to interrupt me. I'm going to try to introduce neural networks in terms of something that is going to be more familiar to a lot of people, namely maximum entropy models, log linear models. So if you have a question of that form, David, this is a really dumb way of introducing neural networks, then save that question for the end of this section. But please feel free to tell me that, but save it for the end of the section. But if you don't get something, please feel free to interrupt me. Okay, so log linear models. How many people have seen log linear models or maximum entropy models before? All right, great. Okay, so imagine we're translating English to Chinese. This is a very, very restricted task. We're translating English words to Chinese words. So this is not full MT. This is just a word-to-word translation task. So our training data is like bilingual bigrams of English and Chinese words, and our job is to predict the best Chinese word given an isolated English word. Never mind why we want to do this. This is just the example. So you can think of a maximum entropy model in the following way. We're going to define a bunch of features, and the features that I'm going to define at first are really simple ones. The features are just going to be binary features that fire for a given English word and a given Chinese word. So if the English word is immunization and the Chinese word is man yi, then a feature will fire that corresponds to that English word and that Chinese word. And that feature will be associated with a certain weight, positive or negative real valued weight, and then the probability of the Chinese word given the English word is proportional to, sorry, there should be a summation here, is the exp of the sum of No, there's no summation. It's just proportional to the x of the weight corresponding to that English word and that Chinese word. And this means it's proportional to, so if I wrote it out, there'd be a normalization constant that says divided by the sum of the x of w, e, comma, c for all other possible Chinese words. Okay, so this is maximum entropy model, where my features are just bilingual bigram features. Does that make sense? Okay, so I'm going to train this thing. So these W, E, comma, C's are the parameters of the model. I'm going to train them to maximize the likelihood, conditional likelihood of my training data, English given Chinese. I can do this using stochastic gradient descent or whatever, and I'll end up with an estimate of the parameters. And it turns out that the probability estimate that I get will be exactly what you're used to, what you would get by just counting and dividing. Just because of the features that I've chosen, you're just going to get your standard count and divide model. So this is not a very interesting example, but this is where we're going to start. Okay, so it's also not really a very good model. So if you look at the relative frequencies, if you look at the probabilities that you would get if you trained the model like this, you would see something like this. If you spell immunization with a Z, so immunization, then the most likely translation is jiezhong. But if you write immunization with an S, then the most likely translation is mian yi. If my English word is vaccination, which means basically the same thing as this, then it's a tie between jiezhong and yi miao. And if the English word is inoculation, this word mian yi is impossible because it's never been observed in the data. So I have a zero probability. Otherwise, it's equally tied between those two Chinese words. So this table doesn't look very good, right? It's because of sparse data. These words don't occur that often in the training data. It's true that inoculation means something slightly different from those first three words. Somehow it can be used in some more metaphorical context than the other three, but these two, I claim, definitely mean the same thing. These really are the same English word, right? It's just an American versus British spelling. And so it's really messed up that the model thinks that this one should be translated using one Chinese word and this word should be translated using another Chinese word. If I had more data, then this would all get fixed up, right? And so something wrong with this model. So there's various ways of fixing this. You could do some kind of smoothing, or you could buy more data. But barring those kinds of solutions, one thing we could do is we can add more features to the model. Or actually, we should take out our old features and replace them with a simpler set of features. So maybe I should define features that don't look at the Chinese-English word pair, but you could look at the entire English word, or you could do things like look at the part of speech of the English word, or you could look at the five-letter prefix of the English word, or you could design features that just fire when the word is a certain length. You could dream up any kinds of properties of these words that you think might be relevant for how to translate them. Right? Does that make sense? And in particular, if we look at the five-word stem, then we've dropped the Z versus S distinction, and that should smooth out the differences between immunization and immunization, right? And it's the job of the designer of the model to come up with features that capture the salient information about these words. So we can visualize this as the following network. So we have English words that go in, and these all determine certain features that we've predetermined. So these are these feature functions HI. So like this guy, maybe this guy is the feature that looks to see if it has a prefix immune. So this edge would have weight 1, this edge would have weight 1, but these other edges would have weight 0. Does that make sense? So each one of these units computes the different feature that I've designed. Okay, and then the top part of this network looks just like before. So then there'll be weights that the model has to learn to try to predict the Chinese word given the values of those features that I designed. Okay, does that make sense? So we're still firmly in the realm of standard log linear models that have been studied for many years in natural language processing. We're just visualizing them in this graphical way. Okay, any questions? All right. Okay, so something that I don't know if people do it anymore, actually. People used to do this. So when they're designing log linear models, they would design some basic set of features, and then they would start throwing in more features. And these features would be the conjunctions of all the other features. Have you guys seen this before? So for every pair of features, you can make a new feature that says E is immunization, and the part of speech tag of E is NN, and so forth and so forth. And you can do the conjunctions of 3 features, conjunctions of 4 features. You could do disjunctions of features. You could do negations of features. I suppose you could do all kinds of things. right? And so now we're going to have a much, much bigger feature set than before, and maybe we can learn some interesting, the model is able to do some more intelligent things by having access to these additional features, right? Are there any plausible examples of what would be a good conjunction? Actually, I don't know. There are definitely examples of what would be a bad conjunction in here. So at least this makes sense, right? E is immunization and the part of speech tag is NN. But like this feature never is going to fire. This feature fires when E is immunization and the length of E is less than 5, which is impossible, right? So this feature is useless. This feature is trivial because this feature fires when the word is immunization and the 7-letter suffix is -ization. And that's equivalent to this original feature, right? So some conjunctions are pointless, but some conjunctions might be kind of interesting like this one. Okay, so this was kind of an interesting way of designing log linear models, but it's very wasteful because it produces a lot of features, like really a lot of features, most of which are really bad. And then you have to do something like L2 regularization or L1 regularization to try to throw out the bad ones and so on and so on and so on. So maybe there's a better way. So the idea is to make programmable features. So I'm going to make, making all of these hardwired features, and a lot of them, I'm going to make a smaller number of like universal features, like a universal remote. You can use one universal remote to replace a whole bunch of different like hardwired remotes. I'm going to make like a universal feature that has knobs inside it that will let me select what kind of combination of the basic features I'm going to do. And it's going to work like this. If I want to simulate a negation, I could say 1/2 minus the value of a feature and then test whether it's positive. That's the same as negation. Right? I'm assuming the Booleans are like zeros and ones, like in C. Right? If I want to do a conjunction, I can add up the two features, subtract 1.5, and then test whether it's positive. That'll give me an AND. If I want a disjunction, then I can add up the two values of the feature, subtract 0.5, and test if it's positive. That'll give me a disjunction. And so we can actually get these logical operations just by taking some linear combination of features, maybe adding some constant term, and then testing whether it's positive. Okay? Does that make sense? So that's interesting, right? So I can make this programmable feature, this blue circle is this programmable feature, whose value is some linear combination of the input features plus some constant term, and then test whether it's greater than 0. And now I have these values V1, V2, and B, and these are the knobs that I can adjust in the programmable feature. And depending on the settings of those knobs, I might get different ways of combining my basic features into some more complicated feature. Does that make sense? Okay, and I'm going to have a bunch of these, I'm going to initialize them randomly, and then we're going to automatically learn what these V's and B's are. Okay, and the hope is that the model will automatically learn, here's a good conjunction of features. This seems to help improve my likelihood. Here's a good negation of a feature. Here's a good disjunction of features. And the ones that are useless, then the model just won't do those. And we just decide in advance how many of these programmable features we have, and that will control, hopefully, that will control overfitting. Too many features and you might have overfitting, too few and you might underfit. Okay, does that make sense? All right, so the only change that we have to make in order to make this learnable is we have to deal with this, we have to deal with this greater than 0. This is a nasty function to optimize. So if we graph the function x is greater than 0, it's this step function, right? And if you try to do gradient descent on this function, you're not going to get very far. Because if you're here, then you're going to say, I shouldn't go anywhere because the gradient is 0. And if we happen to write it as 0, then we'll say, oh crap, the gradient is infinite, and then we'll jump all the way to infinity. This is not good for gradient-based methods. So we smooth it out into this sigmoid function. And there are different choices for what you can use for the sigmoid function. You can use the logistic function, hyperbolic tangent. Yesterday we talked about rectified linear units. There's different ways of making this function, but you don't want this step function. So we're going to change that test for positivity, and replace it with this some kind of curve like this. Okay, so that gets us a network that looks like this. We have our input words, English words, and these are going to determine my basic features. So this is like, is my prefix immune? Is it a noun? And is the suffix -ization? And then these programmable features are here. This is the sigmoid function, and then some linear combination of the basic features and some constant term. Okay, so that's my probability model. So I can form the likelihood out of this, and then tune my model to maximize the conditional likelihood. So I'm going to optimize these guys, the W's, and I'm going to optimize the V's, and I'm going to optimize the B's. I think that should be BJ, not just B. So B,
yeah, BJ, right?
BI or BJ, something like that. BI. Okay, so now this is starting to look more and more like a neural network, right? Okay, so the last thing that we want to do is, maybe I don't want to even choose these basic features, because it's a pain to try to think of what are the interesting features of the word. Can't we learn those automatically also? And the answer is sure, why not? So where there used to be like an HI of E, I'm just going to stick in a parameter called U sub EI, and those are going to be learned automatically also. And so we no longer call these features, these are typically called word embeddings now. Okay, because there's going to be, well here there's three of them, so these are just going to be three real numbers that are connected with each word. Each word is going to get a different set of three numbers, and we could interpret that as a point in a three-dimensional space. So what this network is going to learn is an embedding of this English vocabulary into a three-dimensional Euclidean space, which you can visualize and have fun with, and hopefully it'll capture something about the meaning of that word, or at least the substitutability of that word. All right, so this is a feed-forward neural network with one hidden layer and with this word embedding layer. And you could use this for translating English words into Chinese, and I'm not sure how it would do. But it is actually a fairly straightforward generalization of maximum entropy models, which have been used in NLP for a really long time. It's just that you add this idea of programmable features, both here and here. And as a technical point, maximum entropy models are convex, so if you use stochastic gradient descent to optimize them, you are guaranteed to converge to the maximum, and that is definitely not true. By adding these hidden variables and these extra parameters, the objective function is definitely not convex. So you have to do your optimization more carefully. All right, any questions? No? All right. Okay, so it's kind of obligatory to show what these word embeddings look like just because they're fun to look at. So this is not from the model that I just showed you. This is from a language model. So predicting the next English word given the previous four English words. 5-gram English language model trained on English gigaword, 2 billion words of English. A subset of English gigaword, 2 billion word subset. And this is obviously not all the words. These are only the words ending in shun, T-I-O-N. And I know, these are always a lot of fun to look at. So you get what you would hope. Can you see this? It's really small, I'm sorry. So here in this little cluster, you have four words, inoculation, immunization, vaccination, immunization. So great, the language model is able to learn that these four words occur in the same context, and indeed they have very similar meanings. And you could spend a long time looking to see what the model thinks is similar and not similar to each other. But it's great that there are many, many pairs of S and Z words that get put next to each other because the model knows that they're basically the same word. So this particular aspect of neural networks and natural language is attracting a lot of attention right now. So people are really into word embeddings, whether they're learned by neural networks or distributional methods or whatever. And there seems to be a lot of juice in this particular area of natural language. And it's kind of a very concrete proxy for the meaning of a word, just to say it's just this vector, and I have no idea what the meanings of these features are, I just know that they seem to clump together similar words. And yeah, there seems to be interesting stuff going on in there. Yes?
So when you switch from the features to the automatic
embedding,
when you learn this embedding, does it still look inside the word?
No. You could design a network differently to look inside the word. Yeah, that's a really good question. Did it make sense? So, there exists a weight setting that will make a feature that only fires on words ending in -ization, but it would probably be pretty tricky for the network to automatically find that particular setting. So if you want to give it some help, you could add additional units that look at substrings of the word. That would probably help it along. Any more questions? want to stare at this a little longer. Yes?
Like it's high dimensional space for embeddings, and these are just the two most important.
I use TSNE to do this, and I don't know how it works. It's not just PCA, it does something a little fancier. But someone here can probably explain it better than I can. I think first you do PCA to reduce it down to 30 dimensions or something, and then you use this thing called TSNE to get it down to 2. So now I'm ready to move on to the second part of the talk, which is about how to train these neural networks faster than we previously thought. And this is a paper that Ashish presented at EMNLP last year. Okay, so we're going to switch gears a little bit. We're not talking about translation for this part of the talk. We're just going to talk about language models. So you have a certain number of English words in, and you're trying to predict the next English word. So here's what the neural network looks like for a language model. This is a very, very standard Bengio-style neural probabilistic language model. And it's super similar to what I showed you before, except you have multiple input words, right? So this would be like received, and this is like immunization. Each circle represents a word, so we have a vocabulary of 5. And then each of these guys maps to a word embedding using the same mapping. So we use the same mapping. This matrix is the same as this matrix here. And then those word embeddings are combined into a single set of programmable features, hidden units. And then there's a second layer of hidden units, just in case you need to do like an AND of an OR, or a, you know, I don't know, an OR of an AND. And then finally, those generate the output word. Okay, so really similar to before, just a little bit extra wrinkles to handle the multiple input words. And there's a second hidden layer for good measure, which I believe actually doesn't help that much, but we use it anyway. So one of the technical challenges that happens both during training and decoding is the normalization at the output layer. So at the output layer, we have to compute a probability. The sum of all the numbers that come out of here have to sum to 1. And the way we do that is we calculate the numbers, and then you sum them up and you divide by the sum in order to force the normalization, right? So there's this constant z that we have to compute. Every time we want to calculate a probability, we have to sum over all of those output units, both during training and decoding. So if you're interested in digit recognition, where your input is some really big image, right? Like, what is it? Like the NIST recognition, MNIST is like 784 units here or something like that. But the output's just 10 digits. All you have to output is 0 through 9. Then it's no big deal to sum over 10 output units and normalize. It's no big deal. But if we're trying to predict the next English word, then my vocabulary is going to be at least like 10,000, but preferably more like 100,000 or more. And suddenly summing over all those output units is a lot more expensive than in your typical classification task. And this is something that affects many, many applications in natural language, just because we're constantly trying to predict words, especially in generation tasks like machine translation, where we have to spit out words, and so we by necessity have a very large output vocabulary. So for a while, so I mentioned that Ashish was talking to me about this stuff for like 5 years. In the first couple of years, this is the wall we kept running up against. Like, how are we going to do translation with neural networks when we're stuck with this really huge output vocabulary? And in practice, if you time the training of one of these language models, these timings were done using Holger Schwenk's toolkit, CSLM, then you can see the training time in seconds is basically linear in the vocabulary size. And here we've only gone up to 70K, but we'd like to go beyond 70K if possible. I forget, is this per epoch or what? Because actually 4,000 seconds is not that bad. But yeah, this is probably a small data set and per epoch. Yeah, I'm not sure, but the take-home message is the linear scaling of the vocabulary size, which is bad news. So I talked a little bit about why that's true in decoding. We just, in order to get these probabilities, we have to do the normalization. And I want to explain a little bit about why this is true during training also. So, you have to take the gradient of that z, and this is going to work out to some kind of summation over the output vocabulary. But here's a pictorial way of thinking about it. Suppose I have an incoming training example, u, w, u is the context, so like my 4 preceding words, and I have to predict the output word w. And here's my vocabulary. It starts with A, then ahin, and it ends with ZZ. And suppose that the next word, the correct next word is Lederhosen. And here is my predicted distribution. So the model thinks that A is possible, A is very unlikely, and the model thinks that Lederhosen's a pretty good chance. These guys should sum to one. I think the way I've drawn it, I think the bars are already taller than one, but these bars should sum to one. This should be a probability distribution. So the model makes its guess about what the distribution of the next word is, and then the correct answer comes in, and the gold standard says the next word is in fact Lederhosen. So we make an update to the model, and the update to the model is proportional to these arrows. So all the wrong answers get mushed down proportional to how likely the model thought they were, and the correct answer gets pushed up proportional to 1 minus how likely the model thought that word was. Okay? It's pretty intuitive, right? So this is the update that has to happen. The problem is that the number of arrows here is like 100,000. We have to make an update for every single possible output word. So this is what takes time. We have to do this for every single training example. So the running time of the training is going to be the number of training examples, 2 billion, times the number of word types, which is 100,000, times the number of epochs, which is like 10, if you're lucky. So that's going to be some really, really huge number, and we don't want to do this. So instead, we can use a learning method called noise contrastive estimation, which gets around these problems in a very convenient way. So the algorithm works like this. For each training example, UW, we're going to generate K noise samples. So in practice, we just use a unigram language model to generate K random words. K is like 100. Some people say you can get away with as few as 10. So these are just going to be like 100 random words. And then, instead of training the model to predict the next word, we train the model as a binary classifier. And its job is to distinguish the real word from the fake words. Okay, so it has a series of training examples. And it knows which ones are real and fake. But the model's job is to learn to predict which ones are real and which ones are fake. Does that make sense? So we changed the task from a word prediction task to a counterfeit detection task. And the learning looks like this. So for each training example, UW, we have one real word, Lederhosen, and we have 10 random words drawn from the unigram distribution. And now the model's job is just to learn that these guys are the fake ones and this guy is the real one. So the update to the model looks like this. So there's the update is proportional to these arrows. So the gray bars are the model's idea of how likely is this word to be a real word. So these bars no longer have to sum to one. And the update is there's an update downward for every single word proportional to how likely there's an update for each fake word proportional to how likely the model thought it was a real word, and there's an upwards update for the real word proportional to how likely the model thought it was a fake word. Does that make sense? Okay, so intuitively it's really similar to before, but I only have to do this 11 times instead of 100,000 times. So this update is much, much, much faster than the update that I showed you before. The cool thing, there's a couple of cool things about this method. The cool thing is, according to the theory, under the right conditions, NCE will converge to the same parameter estimate that maximum likelihood does. This is in the limit of infinite data, infinite noise samples, and stuff like that. In practice, it turns out that it works quite well. Bears out the theory. As a bonus, this normalization Z actually turns into a parameter of the model, and NCE can estimate that parameter along with all the other parameters of the model. So we no longer have to compute Z explicitly by doing summations. We can actually just look up Z in a lookup table. Does that make sense? So when it comes time to do decoding, if I want to know the probability of an n-gram, then I run my n-gram through the neural network, and then I just look up the normalization constant in a table, I divide by the normalization constant, and I've got my probability. It's not going to sum to 1 anymore, it's going to sum up to like 1.1 or 0.9, it's going to be close enough. And that's close enough is usually good enough for machine translation. So an even nicer trick from Minet and Te is that they just actually freeze this parameter Z to 1. In other words, they impose a constraint during training that tells the model you need to try to learn as close as possible to a normalized distribution. So those numbers that come out raw at the output units, that should be close to a normalized distribution already. And it turns out that, it's close enough. It's not exactly, it doesn't automatically sum to 1, but it sums up to like 0.8 or 1.2 or something like that. So the great thing about that is during decoding, we don't need to do any normalization at all. You don't even need to do the lookup because we just know that Z is always equal to 1. So we can do lookups on this neural network very fast also. And there's no dependence on the size of the output vocabulary at all. Does that make sense? So NCE is really good for us both in training and also in decoding. So this is the graph that I showed you before. This is the training time if you use maximum likelihood, CSLM, and if you time the training of NCE, it's basically flat. This is great. And we've tested this up to 100K. We really should go above 100K, but we've gone up to 100K.
So does it NCE require that you train the model to generate the
large samples? Sorry? Oh, but it's just a unogram model, though. It's very simple. Yeah. In fact, we tried using a more sophisticated model to generate the noise samples. It doesn't perform as well. The theory says it should do better, but in practice, the simple model did better.
And you're using the samples to directly train from random initialization. You don't already
have random initialization. And I think this is 100 noise samples. So if I did another graph where I graph the training time as a function of k, then it would be linear again. The training is linear in k, but k is small. It's like 100. And doesn't seem to have a huge impact on the quality either. Yes?
If you then like predicting using the new model, where do the words come from? So because previously it was actually able to generate the next word.
Yes.
But now it can only confirm whether
candidate. Oh, yeah. Good question. So. The answer is that we train it like a binary classifier, but the resulting model is exactly the same as before. So you can use the new model for word prediction also. It's just the way the criterion that you use for training it is as a binary classifier. I hope that makes sense. And anyway, during MT, we only want to score existing words. So yeah, we can definitely do that. So you just present the model with n-grams and it gives you back a probability.
So for MT, you actually rely on the translation table that suggests the word.
Yeah. But if you wanted to, you could generate words, but you'd have to do the usual thing. You have to loop over your output vocabulary and sample from that resulting distribution. Yeah. Was there another question? Okay, so I'm going to move on to the next part now. And the results will be in the next part also. Yeah? So the normalization constant depends on you, not you, the context, the previous words, right? So if you didn't use the normalization constant, you would still get a number. We tried this, actually. You would still get a number out. You could still, like, train the MT system, and you'd probably get something meaningful. But because that normalization constant is different for different contexts, there would be some kind of... Yeah.
So it doesn't
matter. But because the normalization constant depends on the content and the context, and the context was generated by previous translation decisions,
yeah.
It's not going to. If you're asking, will the sentence probability be proportional? Will the unnormalized sentence probability be proportional to the normalized sentence probability? The answer is no. Does it make sense?
Yeah.
If the question is, will this work well enough for MT, I think the answer is maybe yes. But the nice thing is we can do a little bit better than that and get that normalization close to one. So then we really think it's good enough. Okay, so now we're ready to talk about machine translation. As a reminder, we're using, I've been talking about training language models, n-gram language models, and n-gram language models are a really, really important component of machine translation systems in order to guarantee fluent output. So if we throw one of these things into an MT system, we do not use it to replace the n-gram language model. I don't think that n-gram language model is ever gonna die. We're gonna use it in addition to the n-gram language model. So if you're familiar with minimum error rate training, it's just an additional feature of our discriminative model. In fact, we don't use Merit. We use something else, but yeah. So our model consists of this bag of features, and the neural network language model is going to be one of those features. So here's some results on the NIST 2009 task, Chinese English. And this is a Hyrule-style system. Yeah, it's a Hyrule style system. So baseline blue scores, 38.4, 37.7, 34.3. If we use this language model to do n-best re-ranking, I don't remember what n was to do the re-ranking, we get a small improvement. So 0.2, 0.1, 0.4 improvement. So that's, you know, we take whatever we can get, but that's not a great improvement. So what we were really interested in this experiment is, can we integrate the language model into the decoder? And this was something that either had not been done before, or maybe one person had done it before. Just because it used to be so slow to look up probabilities in the language model, but after we were able to eliminate the Z, the lookup time became much faster, and we're able to actually integrate it into the decoder, and not slow down the decoder too much, then the blue improvements become a lot better. So this is a 1.1 improvement, 1.1, I don't know what happened there, that's only 0.6. Okay, so NBEST re-ranking versus integrated decoding makes a big difference. Yes?
During Gale, 5 years ago, yeah, there was good blue scores on the order of 35, 36.
Yeah.
It was not true that the blue scores ordered consistent with human,
yes,
human people.
Yeah.
Are these blue scores gonna be better if they're 39 instead of 38, or is it still random?
Usually a blue point difference is pretty good. I don't know. Adam, do you know? How much blue do you need to be fairly confident about a human improvement?
It really
varies. Yeah, okay.
With large improvements.
Yeah.
Yeah, that, I think the small difference is, you know, there's a lot of noise.
Yeah, the difference between blue 10 and blue 30 was substantial,
yeah,
in the right direction.
Yeah.
But 38,
30, 39.
And the stuff that we looked at,
yeah,
completely random.
Oh.
Are you going to check the results?
Yes. No, I'm not going to actually show their results table. I'm going to talk about their model, but yeah. So yeah, they were using a neural translation model. They were able to get like 3 blue points improvement.
Uh-huh.
I have not compared the examples side by side, so actually, I wouldn't be able to tell you, would you be able to notice this difference? I know that over time, after you've accumulated 10 blue points, then anybody can see the difference. Okay, here's another test of a larger language model on a larger MT system. So this is our Bolt system. We're able to get a 0.7 improvement on one of our best systems. So that was encouraging to see. So one question that comes up is the vocabulary size actually important? So one of the big selling points that I gave you for this faster training is it removes the dependence on vocabulary size. And if we want a larger vocabulary, now we can use a larger vocabulary. And so one natural question would be, does it actually matter? When you have a really large vocabulary, there's a tail of words at the end which are very low frequency. Is the network actually able to learn the probabilities of those rare words well? This graph suggests that at least up to 100K, yes, the vocabulary size does matter. So here's 3 different test sets, MT03, MT04, MT05, and I drew these trend lines, but some of them, I admit, are very loose fits, but you can see that the general trend is upwards, that there's a more blue improvement when you have a larger vocabulary.
Yes?
Just the neural language model. Just the neural language model. So there's an unk word. So if you go past the vocabulary size and it just gets mapped to unk, and the neural network just sees unk. But the rest of the system, in particular the n-gram language model, sees the real word. Okay, so that's language models. So now I'm going to talk about translation models, which was developed at BBN over this past year. Okay, so here, before we were just predicting the English word given the previous 3 or 4 English words. One of the nice things about neural networks is that they're able to manage quite a lot of context and figure out what the interesting things are about that context. So what BBN did was they said, well, language models are nice, but why don't we throw in 11 more words of Chinese context also? And we're doing Chinese to English translation now, not English to Chinese. So relations is being predicted given that have diplomatic and this entire 11-word window. This is a huge amount of context. And if you wanted to estimate an n-gram language model this way, you wouldn't have a prayer. It's just too many words. Well, yeah, it would be a really large file on disk. I wouldn't want to use that thing. So they use a neural network to learn this model, predicting the next English word, given the previous English words, and an 11-word foreign window, and it turned out to work really, really well. Before that, they also tried language models, and they saw the kinds of improvements that I showed you before, maybe a little smaller because they were doing a re-ranking. And they also tried just doing predicting English given just the Chinese words, and they were getting very small improvements. And it was only when they conditioned on both the English and Chinese, then all of a sudden they started seeing really, really large improvements. And yes?
How's the context of the Chinese words?
Oh, that's a good question. So during translation, we're assembling together all these rules, and the rules have word alignments inside them. So the system knows that relations is aligned to this Chinese word. And then it's the 11-word window, 5 to the left, 5 to the right, and the Chinese word itself. That if the word is unaligned, then these weird heuristics come into play. But basically, the system knows what the alignment is.
Alignment done beforehand? Or?
Yes. Yeah, because the rules are extracted from word align data. So basically, those word aligns are just kept on the translation rules. Okay, I don't have BBN's results, which were truly impressive. They did like the Chinese to English, looking to the left, and then they added one that looks to the right, and that added an improvement. And then they did the reverse direction, and they added another model, and each one kept giving it more and more improvement. And on Arabic, they ended up with like 3 blue points of improvement, which is fantastic. We have just re-implemented the basic model, which is the one that I showed you here. So this is, they call this the source to target, left to right model. And for their system, they got like a 1.5 improvement because they did some domain adaptation stuff and stuff like that. So in our re-implementation, we got an improvement of 0.7 on this particular test set. On another test set, I've seen in the neighborhood of 1.5. So we've done this on both of our MT systems, and the average improvements is, I think it's comparable to what they reported in the paper, although on this bar graph, it doesn't look comparable. But like I said, they did some domain adaptation stuff, which we did not do. So this is great. This model works great. You could think of this model as a highly souped up version of the T-table in an IBM-style word-based translation model, right? Which just tries to predict the English word given the French word. And here we just throw in 13 more words of context, turn into a neural network, and it suddenly works much better than before. So one thing that I've been interested in is, can we take the other components from word-based translation, this is very retro, to take the other components from a word-based translation model and neuralize those also? So can we get anything interesting? So the fertility model predicts for each Chinese word, if this is in my IBM model 3, right? For each Chinese word, it predicts the number of English words that it translates from. So probability of 2 given this Chinese word. So if we want to make a fancier version of this, we can predict the fertility of this word given not only the word, but also the 11 word window around it. So this is like a neural fertility model. And the IBM models also have a distortion model. I think this is a little different from this is more like the HMM's distortion model. So if I'm translating the word with, and I know that relations came from this word, then which Chinese word should I choose in order to generate the next English word? So in fact, it's this one, and so the distortion is 1, 2, 3. Does that make sense? So this measures the amount of reordering that takes place when we go from Chinese to English. So relations came from here, with came from here, and so we had to jump back 3 positions in order to generate with. So we have a distortion model that says, what's the probability of jumping back 3 positions? So in the IBM papers, I think it was literally just probability of -3, I think. But if you actually look in the implementation of Giza++, there's some lexicalization in there. It tries to look at the words, but I think it's very limited. Here we can say, what's the probability of -3 given my previous 3 English words and given the 11 word Chinese window? And maybe we can predict the distortion better this way. So here's some results. We got a 0.7 improvement from adding the word translation model. When we add the fertility model, we get another 0.4. When we add the distortion model, we get another 0.3. So the total improvement is 1.4, which we're pretty happy about. This is our test set. We have another test set that we call SysComTune. I think the total improvement there is bigger, actually. But then there's more gain from the word translation. That's a kind of our day-to-day test set, development set. I think what this suggests is that there are really a ton of things to try. You can just take some what you thought were very simple models and throw in a whole lot of context, and they seem to work well. And there's really the sky's the limit of things that could be tried, and just add them in as additional features of the MT system. There was a brief discussion yesterday about, like, do you make the neural network the whole system, or do you just include it as a part of a bigger system? So these are definitely in the vein of neural network components inside some larger system which is already known to work. There's another strand of research which I had not mentioned at all here of, can you build an MT system which is like a neural network from end to end? And that's significantly more challenging, but very interesting. All right, any questions? Okay, so just to wrap up, neural networks can be thought of as similar to maximum entropy models, but they automatically discover their own features. They're also able to utilize large amounts of context very well and figure out interesting salient bits of that context, seemingly without too much overfitting. dealing with large output vocabularies, which was really, really important for MT, that was an obstacle that's been removed using noise contrastive estimation. There are a lot of topics that have contributed to the resurgence of neural networks, so like deep neural networks, like having 3, 4, 5, 6 hidden layers, unsupervised pre-training. These were things that for a while people were saying it's critical to use these things in order to get good performance out of neural networks. But it seems, maybe speech guys can correct me, it seems in the last few years, all of the really interesting results are actually very, very simple. 1 or 2 hidden layers, no pre-training, you just use stochastic gradient descent with like Adagrad or something like that. And you use a lot of data, you use a lot of hardware, and that seems to be how people are getting results these days. And so a lot of the stuff that for a while people thought was really important doesn't seem to be that important. And a lot of the neural network technologies that we're using is mostly stuff that was developed in the 70s. It's kind of weird. 80s, okay, 80s. But the multilayer perceptron is really old, right? Oh, okay. Large improvements in machine translation are possible, and seems to be a good reason to think that there are future large improvements to be had in the future. So, any final questions? Yes?
So, thanks for an excellent talk. And at the beginning, you said that when we don't like the way you describe neural networks starting from I actually liked it very much. Like, to me,
okay, good, thanks.
It was very enlightening, and now myself, I can sort of believe that they will work. And, well, they do work.
Okay, good.
So I wanted to ask you, what was the lesson that you learned, or how would you explain that they generally work? Was it already the thing you described?
I think so. I think so. And it would be great if you could dig into those features and try to understand what the features were, but this is notoriously one of the really hard things about neural networks. It's really hard to understand what's going on in there. It's not like, oh, that feature is the one that looks at the four-word suffix, and oh, this one is the one that's the conjunction of those other two. It's definitely not simple like that. So far, it's been mainly a black box. We did some interesting stuff on recurrent neural networks, trying to understand what those guys are learning, and came up with some interesting findings. But for these, I really couldn't tell you anything about what those units were doing. For recurrent neural networks, it seemed like it was learning some syntax, which was super interesting. There was a unit that you could tell was learning noun phrases, and there was a unit that you could tell was learning verb phrases. It was super interesting. But that's not relevant here. Yes?
Thanks for a really nice story.
Thanks.
So I guess given the topic of this workshop, I was wondering if you had any thoughts on kind of using meaning representation or predicting some kind of intermediary level of meaning to do MT.
Yeah. Well, so there's a camp of people who say that these word embeddings are an intermediate representation of meaning, right? And then other people, more level-headed, say, well, no, it's actually a representation of how likely is this word to appear in the same context that another word appears in. And then maybe some people say, well, that is what meaning is. I don't know. This gets kind of philosophical. And when you look at the word embeddings, indeed, it does seem like words with similar meanings or entirely opposite meanings get clustered together in the word embedding space. And so possibly you could pass this off as, in some sense, a meaning-based translation. I don't know if that answers your question or not. Are you talking about?
It does. I mean, okay. I was just thinking specifically things like abstract meaning.
Oh, wow.
So
we're definitely interested in AMR, but I have no idea how we combine that with this stuff. They seem to be quite different worlds. There's some very interesting and productive work on combining formal semantics and distributional semantics. I don't think any of them have touched translation, but they're doing really interesting stuff.
Well, one quick question. Mm-hmm. Have people done any studies to see, are these translations obtained using these word embeddings kind of any more sensible in some of the cases?
I think this is related to your question.
It seems like there are several studies to be done with data.
Yeah, I plead guilty to not having done enough of that kind of study.
particular to get into this talk properly. It's saying all these previous models, like every model one, you can now do a better job at throwing the kitchen sink.
Yeah, that would be cool, right? Yeah. I'm not sure I understand the question. What do you mean by representational capacity?
I mean, we're using all the same sort of data we already had, but fitting it a little bit better.
So So inventing is an awfully anthropomorphic word, but so the network does have the capacity to learn any word-based feature that you could have thrown at it. Like literally any word-based feature is possible. So in that sense, the model could, in principle, learn any word-based feature. But maybe your question is, can this model learn anything about syntax? No, it's just not part of the structure of the model. Maybe could have done the same thing. Yeah.
Maybe one didn't fit the data quite so well, but that seems like the big gain is not in the fact that using neural networks and neural networks is a tool to fit the model decision to use.
Yes. Definitely.
So that's why I see that first bullet point is a little, this whole movie that you see all this year about neural networks being a big grand thing.
But it was really hard, if not impossible, to model that much context before. The conjunctions of features would have been so incredibly huge with 14 words of context.
Right, so I think it's point myself, but I'm totally in favor of all this great work in neural networks, but rather than viewing the neural networks themselves as being that the neural networks are going to solve the problem for us, it's more of it's a better hammer for us to make.
Yeah. I think that's fair enough. Yeah, I think that's fair enough. I think it's fair enough. No.
Just a comment on your question about, could you use it to do things that are less than I mean, I'm certainly willing to stipulate that these word embeds give a nice representation of semantic similarity and allow you to generalize from individual flexible items to and that seems like a step in the right direction, but yeah, I mean, it does seem like there's a lot of other information that would be really nice to be able to bring there as well. And you said something about BBM trying to do a little bit of lexicalization. Can you say anything more?
I'm sorry, I don't know.
Yeah, okay. But that maybe that's a direction to pursue.
What do you mean by lexicalization here?
I don't know, you said it.
I don't remember saying that. They tried looking at just the Chinese context, and that didn't work so well. They tried looking at just the English or just the Chinese, and they had to combine the Chinese and English in order to get the results to go. Sorry, I don't know. I don't know. All right, thank you.